Welcome to the Busy Signal. My name is Jim, and this is my retrostalgic 80s, 90s, and early 2000s podcast. This show aims to salute all the stuff from back in the day that is either now extinct or quickly going that way. This episode is all about the future. Where we're going, we won't need roads. Yeah, we're getting in the DeLorean. We're firing up the flux capacitor, and we're going back to the 1980s. Because the 1980s was the future. I think that we can all agree that the 1980s, for at least the purpose of this podcast, can be simplified, oversimplified, into two categories. Creepy and futuristic. And for today, I'm only going to focus on the futuristic. The creepy, that's definitely another episode for another time. We'll get there. There was so much tech innovation so fast in the 1980s that it was dizzying at times. We now lived in a world with computers and Star Wars. Of course, synth music became a thing in the 1980s. I'm an 80s kid. Of course, my second grade picture has a black background with a red 3D laser grid coming at you. So let's check out some of the totally rad, cutting-edge technology that changed the world, courtesy of the 1980s. Just a warning, though, this episode is gonna be a bit nerdy at first, but it's necessary, so hang on, stick with me, and you'll probably be surprised where we end up. It's gonna be pretty cool. VHS, Video Home System. While it wasn't invented in the 1980s, it certainly became the dominant home video medium after a battle with Sony Betamax. And that story is all over the internet. It's been all over everywhere forever. So if you're not familiar with Sony Betamax, Google it. Obviously, VHS is what we all grew up with. It's what we love. It's what we knew as far as how we rented our movies, how we recorded our vacations on our camcorders, all that stuff. VHS cassette tapes. Fun fact, though, even though Sony lost to VHS and actually started making its own VHS recorders and players in 1988, it still produced Betamax until 2002. Why? Who was using Betamax? What was it for? That had to have been a very specific reason. It was still producing Betamax all the way into 2002, 20 years later after the VHS Betamax battle. VHS was game-changing. You could record off the TV, which was massive. It was huge. You could never miss a show. On Saturday mornings, my mom recorded all of my favorite Saturday morning cartoons for me, and I was able to watch them over and over and over again throughout the week because we didn't have things like Cartoon Network or Nickelodeon or, you know, the Disney Channel. I didn't have that. So I watched and rewatched my favorite Saturday morning cartoons. And after a while, you could build up a library of all your favorite cartoons. It was pretty cool. I really wish I still had some of those VHSs. And then, obviously, if you pair up VHS and your VCR with HBO, I mean, come on now. That's like the earliest form of Napster, right? It's gotta be. It was a loophole. You knew a movie, you didn't even have to rent it. You already paid for HBO, so you just taped it, and technically, you owned that movie. Commercial free. That was wild times. See, the thing is, though, with the VHS, you needed a VCR. So the VCR played your VHS cassette tapes, and all you had to do was figure out how to program that VCR. And that was like a big joke back in the day because VCRs really weren't that complicated of machines, but it always seemed like nobody knew how to program it. You had to make sure you had enough tape. The worst thing was going to record a show, leaving the house, thinking that you've set it up to record the show, but you didn't have enough tape left. You were in the middle of that VHS, and all of a sudden you'd be watching your show, and all of a sudden it would just end halfway through because you ran out of tape. You didn't rewind it to the beginning so to make sure you had enough tape. That was brutal. Then after you made sure you had enough tape, you had to make sure you remembered to even set the thing to begin with, to start recording on a specific channel at a certain time.
If your VCR is a pain to program, then get rid of it and get the RCA VCR with VCR Plus and CableBox channel control. To record a show, just look for the VCR Plus code in your TV listing, then punch it in. It's as simple as that. So if you've had it in your old VCR, get rid of it and get the one with cable box channel control built in. The first VCR that changes channels on your cable box. Finally, a VCR that everyone can program.
Bottom line is, Essentially, Netflix can be traced back to VHS. When you think about it, VHS created the home video market, which evolved into home streaming. The only difference is we don't have closets full of unmarked and mislabeled VHS tapes anymore. And camcorders, well, essentially, they were a small VCR that had a camera attached, and you could record anything you wanted as long as you were strong enough to keep that thing on your shoulder and up to your eye and coordinated enough not to trip over anybody and anything. And if you were one of those people that were not coordinated enough, or you were just lucky enough to catch somebody else in a goofy moment, well, then you could have been a $10,000 winner on America's Funniest Home Videos. The camcorder gave us so much entertainment. I mean, I know we have viral videos now with our phones and whatnot, but there's something about those grainy camcorder videos from those early, you know, 90s Bob Saget hosting America's Funniest Home Videos. There's something really special about those videos, those innocent videos of the guy trying to jump over the wall of his pool and his wife happens to catch him, not make it, and now he's destroyed the family pool, and there he goes floating off down the street. Classic. So I did tell you that we were going to get a little bit nerdy with this, and I promise we will, right now. 1981, IBM's personal computer, the 5150. It cost between $2,000 and $4,000, depending on what else you needed to run it. And it was the first personal computer for home use. IBM was a computer giant in the 80s, only briefly rivaled by the Commodore 64 and the Atari 400 and 800. The real competitor, though, was Apple. More on that in a minute. IBM set the standard for what we expected going forward to be able to do at home with computers.
A good time to learn about the IBM personal computer. With this tool for modern times, a person can quickly master such jobs as accounting or word processing. Even use the IBM personal computer to forecast growth. Helping the business person at home to wear many hats while selling even more. And that can be a feather in anyone's cap. The IBM personal computer. Try one on at a store near you.
And it was extremely popular. I don't like doing research, but I did find out that some of these early IBM computers were still being used by the National Weather Service as recently as 2006. That's literally less than 20 years ago. Again, it had to have been for a very specific reason, a very specific task that only these IBM computers were able to do, or I don't know what. Seriously, why were these still being used until 2006 still? That's kind of scary when you think about it. I mean, I'm hoping that the Department of Homeland Security doesn't have any of these things still running, because yikes. I mentioned the Commodore 64. Because just a year later, after 1981, Commodore 64, which the 64 stands for the 64 kilobytes of RAM that it had, was a budget-friendly computer, not the $2,000 to $4,000. It was $595. It was less than $600. And it sold in retail stores, not just like computer hobbyist stores. So it became the highest-selling computer worldwide. The appeal of this one was that not only did it handle business, like your home business, word processing, but it also played games. And some people specifically bought the Commodore 64 for its gaming PC capabilities.
I'm more alive than ever before. What happened to my Commodore 64? My friends are knocking down my door to get into my Commodore 64.
It's mind-boggling. Commodore 64 lets you play hundreds more games than any video machine, plus draw, program, even do music.
I'm more alive.
It was often compared to the Atari 8-bit computers. They looked similar. They kind of looked like a big typewriter. The motherboard and the cards to run the computer were underneath the keyboard, but it was big and chunky. What you would do is you would hook it up to a monitor or a television, and you would hook up a mouse to it, and then all of a sudden you had a full computer. The Atari 400 and 800 computers, like I said, looked like the Commodore 64. Obviously, they were a bit of a different color. And they also sold at retail stores and computer hobbyist stores for cheap, way cheaper than the IBM personal computer. You were playing Pong on this thing. You were playing Donkey Kong on the Atari. It was crazy. So they were selling computers that could do word processing just like the Commodore 64, but people really liked the games.
These families are learning about home computers. The family with the Atari home computer is learning...
Spanish, German,
French,
Italian.
The other...
No foreign languages.
The Atari family is learning...
Three programs teach us to program.
The other...
We've only one.
And while the Atari family learns to play Centipede, Star Raiders, and soon...
E.T.
The other learned...
He made a mistake.
Over 1,000 programs featuring the world's most popular games, but sorry, only with Atari.
So essentially now, what you had was a personal work home computer and an arcade in one machine for cheap. This literally was a game changer. People were looking at computers completely differently now. And then came 1984. More specifically, the Super Bowl in 1984, a commercial.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
On January 24th, 1984, Apple Macintosh computer was released. It was Apple's OG personal computer with a GUI. I told you we're going to get nerdy. Here we go. GUI. GUI, graphical user interface. Now we had a screen that wasn't just black with white text or black with green text and running commands. You had a mouse, a single button mouse, and you could click around and you could double click on things and open programs rather than knowing the commands to open those programs. You had a built-in screen. Technically, this thing, when you bought it, came with a carrying case. It was 16 pounds, which made this portable. Technically, they really were trying to tout the Apple Macintosh computer as not only a personal home computer, but a portable computer as well. I remember using these at school. I remember playing like a Dr. Seuss like math game on it. Schools were really starting even back then in the early 80s, mid-80s, to adopt Apple Macintosh. If anybody remembers, Apple Macintoshes were like the school, and I think they still are, were like the school like official computer. And Oregon Trail. I remember Oregon Trail on an Apple Macintosh, and I always died of a snake bite or dysentery. So that was a tough game. It was an all-in-one, and that was really huge at the time. You didn't have to add a monitor. It came with a monitor. You didn't have to add a mouse. It came with a mouse. It had its own keyboard. Most PCs were in pieces. Keyboard, monitor, floppy drive. This was all together, and that's kind of still the way Apple does it today. When they first introduced this Mac computer, the keyboard did not include arrow keys, function keys, or a numeric pad. They literally didn't want developers just porting existing software over to their Mac from a PC. They wanted a tailored experience. They wanted developers to rewrite their programs specifically tailored to their computer. I mean, really, Apple has been consistent about this over the last 40 years. And you knew it was only a matter of time if we've talked about IBM, we've talked about Commodore 64, we've talked about Atari and Apple. It was only a matter of time before we mentioned Microsoft. Microsoft Windows 1.0. Yeah, it had to start somewhere, didn't it? 1.0 was where it started. The US release for Microsoft Windows is November 20th, 1985. And it was an operating system that ran on top of Microsoft DOS, MS-DOS, which was that black screen that I talked about with the white text. It ran on top of that. Windows 1.0 did for IBM computers and other non-Apple computers what Apple did for the Macintosh. It provided a user with a graphical user interface. And that's just basic now. You're not getting a computer where that's just your operating system nowadays. It always has a graphical user interface. But what this did was it allowed for multitasking. In a plain text operating system, you could only run one program at a time for the most part. And I'm going off of memory. I don't like doing research. So if anybody knows differently, get angry and get at me and shout at me. But I'm pretty sure I remember only being able to run one program at a time. Windows 1.0 allowed for programs to be run simultaneously, each contained within a window. And windows could only be displayed in tiles. In 1.0, you couldn't overlap them like we do now. They were tiled. If you had four windows open, it looked like a house window with four panels. Windows 1.0 also introduced the concept of the click and drag. Previously, you had to run a command to move files from one folder to another. The thing about Windows 1.0 was just like any first iteration of any program, it was slow, it was clunky, and initially it didn't have much software. But like I said, this was the first version. This was the ground floor. And obviously, it made it through that, and it is still dominantly used almost 40 years later. So yeah, 40 years later, we're still talking about Apple and Microsoft. Clearly, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates were onto something. Moving away from computers for a little while, how about we talk about cable TV? Cable TV was not invented in the 1980s, much like VHS was not invented in the 1980s. However, the 1980s is when cable TV exploded. In conjunction with VHS, you paired up cable TV with VHS, the world was yours. Early cable TV was kind of like the Wild Wild West. There was regional and local cable stations, and they were able to deliver more tailored local content than the morning, afternoon, and evening news was able to in a half hour. And then it had a lot of specialty, like niche channels that were available. There were dedicated fishing channels, TNN, which was the Nashville network, MTV, and HBO, particularly the rise in popularity of MTV.
I want my MTV.
I want my MTV.
Call your cable company and say, I want my MTV.
Turn it on. Leave it on. America, see the music you want to see.
I want my MTV. All right.
I want my MTV.
Yeah, too much is never enough.
HBO, TBS, and the Disney Channel really kind of drove cable television. That and the fact that it could be delivered via satellite. If you didn't have physical cables running to your house through your neighborhood, you could get a satellite dish and get cable. That was massive. No, really. Those dishes, some of them took up like your backyard. It wasn't like your little dish on your roof now. Some of those dishes were huge. Oh, and by the way, remember when cable didn't have commercials? And that was like the perk of paying for cable. You didn't have commercials. Yeah, cable TV was a little bit expensive, but you didn't have to sit through commercials. Why do I keep saying this? Because what happened to that? It's all commercials. All right, going to get off my soapbox. Anyway, cable TV got so big that it just became basic, like water and electricity. You moved into a place, you wanted the water turned on, the electricity turned on, the phone turned on, and the cable television turned on. It's like a utility now. What are you listening to this podcast on right now, by the way? Are you listening on your computer? Maybe you're listening to it on a cell phone. Cell phone technology. The first cell phone call was made in the 1970s. However, the cell phone really did go through its infancy in the 1980s. Specifically, let's talk about the Motorola Dynatac 8000X. You don't remember the Motorola Dynatac 8000X? What if I called it by its other name?
Time out.
The Zach Morris phone, or AKA the brick, because it weighed 2.5 pounds. It took 10 hours to fully charge and gave you 30 minutes of talk time in the battery life. How much would you expect to pay for a massive phone like that? $100? $200? Let's go iPhone prices. Are we talking $1,500? No? $3,995. If you saw one of these phones on TV, it was usually by somebody wearing a yuppie business suit or they were on a yacht taking a phone call. This was a status symbol. And they were the OGs of what were to be the smartphones of just 25 years later.
Those who think getting a car phone is not for them, whatever the reason, haven't kept up with the booming industry of cellular radio telephones. Scenes like this are becoming commonplace in U.S. cities where cellular is available today. This revolution in communications could make it possible for more and more people to have a phone in their car, or even one that travels with you. Like this unique cellular portable made by Motorola, which weighs only 30 ounces. Right now, businessmen and women are major users of radio telephones where cellular is in service. But more people will take advantage of cellular as its benefits become apparent. Eventually, seeing people using cellular phones may seem as commonplace as someone checking time on an electronic watch, figuring on an electronic calculator, or programming on an electronic computer. Industry watchers say there are only a few thousand cellular phones in use right now, but that number is expected to grow considerably within the next few years during the cellular revolution.
The next tech innovation we've talked about before We've mentioned how it doesn't exist anymore. We did mention how incredibly big it was, but let's just talk about it for a minute again because, I mean, it was huge, and it was really a tech innovation. It was absolutely iconic, and it is used in most all 1980s imagery now. Anytime you see like a picture that kind of gives a jumble of 1980s paraphernalia, you're always going to see a Walkman in the mix. A personal, private, portable stereo. People were more than ready to receive this when it came out. They couldn't get enough of it, particularly with the exercise community. We've talked about the aerobic phenomenon of the 1980s in the retro fitness episode, but for once, you could be exercising, running, jumping rope, lifting weights, whatever else, anything. You could take your music with you with a Sony Walkman. Personally, I had the yellow sport one. It was really nice, thick yellow plastic, and it locked in your cassette tape. It was great. AM, FM radio, cool headphones. Here's the thing, though. There were numerous copycats. Not all personal stereo cassette players were made by Sony, but they all were Walkman. That's how famous Sony's Walkman was. Even if Sony didn't make it, we still called it a Walkman. Anyway, for more commentary on the Walkman, you can go back and listen to the Once Common Now Extinct episodes and find that. The Walkman was huge, no doubt, and I'll stop bringing it up in episodes, I promise. Now, real quick, we're going to touch on another thing that we have touched on briefly before, CDs. CDs were a 90s thing, really, right?
10 CDs for a penny?
Welcome to the world's largest jukebox. At Columbia House, you get to choose 10 CDs you really want for a penny. Best of all, there's no delay. You're free to enjoy big savings from day one.
Look for this offer in your TV guide, newspaper, or mail.
Get what you want. Columbia House.
Yes, totally. However, the innovation and invention of the CD happened in 1982 in Japan. It was released in America in 1983. And the 80s really were split because I was born in 81 and I can remember vinyl records. Vinyl records were a thing. Everybody had a record collection and turntables, and that's how you listened to your music when I was a young child. However, at some point in time, cassettes came into the mix, and cassettes became the dominant way to listen to music because they were so much more portable. But then comes along the CD. It was like little records, but they were way more portable than cassette tapes, and you didn't need to rewind them. You didn't need to put your pencil in them to get them to go back into the cassette after your cassette deck accidentally ate the tape. You didn't have to peel the little tabs off the top so that nobody accidentally recorded over your favorite songs. However, those early CD players were like the size of a VCR. And I don't even think there was any good reason for it. I got a hold of an early CD player, and there was the tray and the optical, you know, laser to read the disc, but the rest was empty space. I don't know. Everything had to be big in the 80s, just like the hair. By the early 90s, CDs had pretty much taken over the music market, and people had moved over from cassette tapes to CDs. The other thing that helped the CD was the CD-ROM. Not only could you use these as music CDs, but you could put data and information on them, put them in your computer, and instead of floppy disks, now you're using CDs. We've covered all this in other episodes, I know. But man, CDs were awesome, weren't they? And sneaking in at the end of the Raddus decade was Nintendo's Game Boy, which was released in 1989. And this, talk about a game changer. I know I said game changer a lot in this episode because everything is a game changer because tech innovation and the 80s. Wow. But this literally was a game changer. Previously, handheld games were singular. Nintendo's Game & Watch games were singular little games that you bought and played a single game on. It could only play one game. Tiger handheld games, single units, only had one game. Unless, well, we'll get to that in another episode, I promise. Game Boy was an actual portable console with a screen, controller, and speakers built in. All you needed was some AA's and a game cartridge. Oh, yeah, you needed good lighting. Because let's be honest, the original Game Boy was only good in perfect lighting. It couldn't be too dark, and you couldn't be outside in the light or else it was just trash. That being said, it was awesome, and it drove the handheld console market.
they said it wasn't humanly possible. But now you can have all the power and excitement of Nintendo right in the palm of your hand. Introducing Game Boy. It's portable, it's in stereo, and its games are interchangeable. Plus, Game Boy comes with the outrageous new game, Tetris. And for head-to-head competition, use the revolutionary video link and blow your opponent away. Game Boy, only from Nintendo. Now you're playing with power, portable power.
What a time to be alive. Super Mario Land, Tetris, anytime, anywhere, sign me up. And I say that, but at the same time, while I was a Nintendo kid, meaning I owned an NES, a Super NES, and an N64, I did not own a Game Boy. Not right away, at least. I got one much later. Initially, I owned a Game Gear, a Sega Game Gear. And it was blue, and it came with The Lion King. And I hate that game, because anybody who's played The Lion King on Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis, Game Gear, anything, knows that that game is cheap. It is too hard for no reason. Anyway, I did eventually own a Game Boy Color. I bought one in 1999 simply to play Pokemon Red because I wanted a Charizard. Oh, and I also wanted the Game Boy camera and printer. That thing was awesome. So while the Game Boy wasn't really the best in handheld consoles, it was the best. It had the titles, the playability and replay value of the games that it had. They were priceless. It was totally worth it. The Game Boy was the clear winner there. Next innovation, and our last innovation, the clapper. Yeah, the clapper. As seen on TV, the clapper. 1984 gave us one of the most recognizable ad jingles of all time.
Clap on, clap off, clap on, clap off, the clapper.
Let you turn things on or off from anywhere in the room. Just plug in the clapper and a television, lamp, stereo, almost anything you want to clap on and off.
Clap on, clap off, clap on, clap off, the clapper.
The clapper is now available at all Hills department stores, Phase Drugs, and Wegman food pharmacies.
1984 also gave us something that we didn't recognize at the time in the clapper. At least I didn't recognize it. More on that in a little bit. The clapper, just like the commercial, is iconic in its own right. And it was so simple. It was this white plastic, well, maybe not white. It was probably beige. It looks like maybe in my head I'm seeing beige because everything was beige in the 80s, right? It was this beige plastic wall plug that you plugged into an outlet and then you plugged other things into it, like a lamp or a television or the like. And it could be turned off with a quick double clap or turned on with a quick double clap. What myself and possibly many other people didn't recognize at the time is that during the infectious jingle, when the old woman turns over and claps to turn her television off so she could go to bed, was that we were witnessing the birth of the smart home concept. The clapper wasn't perfect. It could be accidentally activated by loud noises or pets, or it didn't just work at all sometimes because maybe you were out of range or you didn't clap loud enough. But despite that, there it was. The seed had been planted for the need for a smart home, or at least the want for a smart home, for automation. For years, it sat there in the as-seen-on-TV aisles and played during reruns and infomercials at 2:30 in the morning on no-name channels. But now the clapper is recognized as a pioneer in tech innovation. Clap on, clapper. Clap on. So my take from this episode, from this deep dive into the 1980s tech innovations, which I clearly did research for against my will, was that the 80s was just a wild time. It was just a wild, weird time to be alive. Home computers were so new that there were barely any standards. Some had monitors, and some looked like big typewriters. Some had games, and some just did word processing. Like, computing was just kind of all over the place. Entertainment mediums were constantly battling against each other and changing. Cutting-edge technology was fleeting. If you thought for a second that you were on the cutting, bleeding edge of technology by buying the newest gadget, within weeks, your gadget was old and possibly even obsolete. VCRs, CD players, boomboxes, TVs, answering machines, pagers, cell phones, regular phones, computers, video game consoles, everything was upgrading and evolving at breakneck speeds. However, all of them have one thing in common today. all of these home stereo, video, computering, communication devices, as big and as clunky as they were in the 1980s, well, they've all been shrunken down, and they're all in your hand or your pocket right now. Your cell phone. It's all of those devices all at once, even the clapper. It's crazy to think, though. Imagine if you told yourself or somebody else that 35 years ago. You'd be nuts. That's what they would tell you. You're nuts. So this episode was a little nerdy, sure, but it was really fun, and it was so awesome and wild even to go back and look at high-tech innovations in the 1980s. It was really cool because I remember a lot of it. I remember my dad having an IBM personal computer. It was cool. I mean, I remember having to run commands, putting in the floppy disk and run a command to get a game going. It was cool. Anyway, enough about me. What did you think? Did I miss anything? Did I unlock some memories? Did you have some of these items, these devices? Did your family have some of these devices? Do you still have some of these devices? And if so, are they still working? If you do, and they are, take a picture, take a video, share it on Instagram, and tag me at BusySignalCast. Big thanks to everybody for listening this week. I hope you guys had just as much fun as I did. Thanks again. Once again, I just want to say thanks for listening. And as always, you can listen to The Busy Signal everywhere quality podcasts are streamed. Hit the subscribe button to have a new episode delivered directly to your favorite device every other Friday. And if you really enjoy the show, leave a positive review. I don't know what that does, but would this be a real podcast if I didn't ask for that? You can also head over to Instagram and follow the show at Busy Signal Cast for even more retrostalgic content. I share a good amount of stuff that isn't mentioned on the episodes. And while you're there, say hi in the comments. And until next time, remember, reach out and touch the past.